This is Almost Entirely Sports with Joshua Briscoe.
We're all hungry for a little nibbling of some delicious Chiefs talk. So here we go. Nom, 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 nom.
On Sports Radio 810 WHB.
Whenever the Kansas City Chiefs have problems that need to be addressed and we need to get to the bottom of them, there's no better place to go with all of the questions that I have that I'm just going to... I've been writing them down and folding them into paper airplanes and just throwing them off the balcony here at 810. I figured what would be a much better use of my time would be to call Ryan Tracy of Locked On Chiefs, of Rogue Analytics, of RGR Football. I thought, you know what? Let's call Ryan instead. Maybe he can explain all of the issues with the Chiefs defense right now. Ryan, how are you feeling about bringing all of the answers that we need in these trying times?
No pressure, man. I like to think of myself as a fixer rather than a, savior. So let's just see what we can get into.
Well, let's see. Yeah, let's see if we can tinker with it a little bit then. Let's see if you can just sort of explain what you're seeing in a couple of places. It still feels kind of silly to, like, lean into the negatives because we're picking nits in terms of the Chiefs as a whole, but you know, that's what the Chiefs are doing right now in their meetings. I'd bet anything. The Raiders have had two good offensive performances, really two excellent offensive performances against this Chiefs defense the two times they've faced off this year. Sunday night didn't look very different from the first time through. I was kind of hoping for maybe something to get a little excited for, and it didn't happen. Whenever you look at what went wrong defensively on Sunday night, where do your eyes go first after taking a little bit of a longer look at it?
You know, it wasn't just the other night. I thought it was a different way. But clearly both times, John Gruden has figured out ways to attack and confound the safeties on this defense. And that's really where the breakdowns were in game in the first meeting. Mm-hmm. And then you saw a different set of breakdowns, but still at the same position group in the second meeting. So Whatever John Gruden has, he's got it pretty good.
That's a great call, I think, because, I mean, we saw them go just bombs away over the top the first time through, but you got a very quiet game from Darren Waller. And then on Sunday, we saw Darren Waller all over the field and kind of matched up one-on-one with Dan Sorensen a couple times, even moving through and around Tyrann Mathieu, which is an unfamiliar and, frankly, unwelcome sight to see him, you know, having his hands full that way. The other element there is that Juan Thornhill played 11 snaps on Sunday. Whenever you dig into that position group a little more particularly, what are you sort of concerned about long-term now between Thornhill, Mathieu, and Sorensen and how the three of them have played in these games?
You know, I think it's about getting yourself in the matchup situations in a way that allows you to absorb what clearly, from what we heard from Tyrann Mathieu, is going to be a reduced role going forward for the foreseeable future for Juan Thornhill. Something that he, in Matthew's words, has to adjust to. That's concerning for me because, as you pointed out on social media, Juan played a lot of snaps prior to the bye.
Yep.
The idea that this is some kind of we're easing him back in, that's not really the case. I am concerned a little bit that the staff feels like they overtaxed him. Mm-hmm. He maybe had some breakdowns that we weren't aware of in terms of physicality. And then maybe after the bye week with some extra rest, they realized, hey, we have to throttle that back in order to be ready for the postseason and have him out there, unlike we had last postseason. And he may be the difference maker when you come down to the more explosive offenses they may have to face.
Yeah, and I mean, I think... I genuinely, this will, you know, make a lot of people very, very shocked, but I try not to be an alarmist at just all angles, right? I think that's not always terribly helpful. But with Thornhill, I think you kind of touched on it there. There aren't a lot of reasons for this throttling back that would be anything other than concerning. Because you're right, I mean, if it's a health thing that they caught on, you know, he played a few less snaps the last few weeks before the bye, and then the bottom dropped out against the Raiders after playing almost all the snaps through, I think it was week 2 through 6 or something like that. If it's health-related, that's scary. If it's performance-related, that's not ideal, although I don't know if you think if it ever showed up on tape that Thornhill was struggling. And if it's simply a preference thing, putting Dan Sorensen as your single high safety on a regular basis, that's also a little concerning to me because I don't think that makes sense for who he is as a player. So I don't know. Do you agree with that idea that it's all a little bit worrisome and if any of those would be maybe the best of a bad bunch?
I mean, there, yeah, I agree. It's all worrisome, and I think you nailed it on the head. It's like we watched the same film because Dan Sorensen, single high. Those are four words I don't want to put in the sentence. You know what I mean?
Right, that's right.
Yeah, this is not what we're looking for. So the comfort level that the staff has is much different than what we see from outside the building. And I think that that's one thing that we just have to acclimate to because it's not going to change. It hasn't changed to this point. Dan's whole career has been the staff believing that he can do more than we see on film. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be what it is. It's not optimal. I agree with you completely. But whether that is because of Juan's performance previously, I don't see it on film myself. I feel like he's been pretty steady. Everyone has a mistake here or there. We have to remember that despite what was a very good season, he's a sophomore in this system. Yeah. So there are bound to be some mistakes, but they don't show up to me. In looking back at Carolina, certainly the Jets and Denver were games where he was really solid. And I thought he actually had one of his better games of his career against Buffalo. And that said, it leads me again towards the precautionary physicality part of it to make sure that you have that X factor that you didn't have in the postseason run last year so that you can let Tyron and Dan do their thing.
We're talking to Ryan Tracy, and Ryan, I reintroduced you because there's I don't think anybody in the Chiefs sort of media landscape that I'd rather talk about some of the line play with, and I've got a lot of things with both lines that I'm really interested to hear where you've kind of landed on a few things. Another issue with the Raiders game was that Derek Carr just didn't seem to get terribly bothered very often. And I think that there's a chance that maybe we collectively, you know, Chiefs Twitter or whatever, may have yanked a little too far in the pass rush's direction because, as you pointed out there, your first issue is looking at the safeties. I think that's totally fair. But at least particularly with Frank Clark and maybe even just the non-Chris Jones department, It's been a bit of a quiet year, seemed certainly to continue against the Raiders. What do you make of the pass rush being just the across the defensive line, not looking at the blitzes and stuff just yet?
You know, you certainly have a point that it has been a quiet year. And what I've been expecting is the buildup to, you know, this year's Mexico trip. Like, when everything clicks and everybody gets their edge back and everybody's feeling good again. And unfortunately, that there is no magical date on the calendar that all happens. Mm-hmm. So I think we're still waiting for that. I'm still not sure where Frank Clark is physically with the knee that supposedly flared up and a couple of other things that look a little hinky to me. But that said, there's still opportunities out there. Four pressures from Frank last week, six from Chris Jones. What it comes down to me is you're getting the initial. You're moving him, him being Carr, off the spot a little bit. Mm-hmm. But you just weren't getting any finishes. Mm-hmm. He only got hit one time that entire game, wasn't sacked. And that physical part, especially for Carr, is really, really important. It's going to be important for Tom Brady. It's going to be important for whether they see Breeze or Taysom Hill or who knows. Mm-hmm. There are some quarterbacks coming down the line that you need to make contact with. And that's part and parcel with being able to up your game if you are one of the stars like Frank or Chris. But it's also in finding a way to light a fire under Tershawn Wharton, for one, who's had a good season. Mm-hmm. But I think there's enough film on him now that they're starting to realize that his pass rush repertoire is a little bit limited. Mm-hmm. He's been making his living on being athletic and being strong. And so he's got to push himself to develop a little bit more. That's Coach Daly, I'm sure, is all over that. Mm-hmm. But also, Tano Passanio doesn't produce a ton of pressure. Mike Dan, as a rookie, we all forget that he's playing a lot of snaps. He's not producing a ton of pressure. Mm-hmm. Those guys have to elevate as well. And especially when you're talking about putting Tano in positions where he has to cover tight ends with, you know, 87 years experience.
Yeah.
that's a difficult thing. Yeah. More power to him, but that's not producing pressure. That's not doing what should be job number one for that front set.
Yeah. I mean, we can just, I feel like whenever we talk, I end up just sort of going through position groups to make sure that I'm like seeing the same thing that you are. It's a nice sort of recalibration. But the linebackers, I would say, they've gotten less heat this year. And I think rightfully so. It seems like there've been bad moments, but maybe it hasn't been, you know, the defense's parking brake that gets thrown in inopportune moments. Willie Gay got a little more work. He got more snaps than Ben Neiman did on Sunday. Neiman still frustrates a lot of people, and I get it, but he didn't play as much against the Raiders. You still get plenty of Damian Wilson. What do you think of how that unit has progressed this year, and if any of those guys positively or negatively have stood out to you at all?
You know, I think as a whole, I think they're probably on par as a group, the 5-6 guys that we're talking about playing. But when you look at the pecking order, when Ben Neiman's now your third, when he should be your fourth, mm-hmm. I think the role that you see Damian Wilson playing in walking down to the line, a la what Reggie Ragland did last year, mm-hmm. I think that's a step back. I think Reggie is much better at that role. Mm-hmm. And so they miss him there. And then it's kind of a trickle-down effect. And your third backer being Neiman, you look in the red zone in particular, that's still problematic. And as much as I, amongst anyone else, wants to see Willie Gay play more snaps, and this was a huge step forward for him against the Raiders, there's still some task-oriented things that he's probably not ready for.
Yeah.
And so there's going to be mistakes there, too. Do you take what might be a fragile confidence and try to stress it, or how does that work out? And I think it's going to come down before the regular season ends, because at that point, I think if they want to make a serious run and be able to combat some of the running backs that can catch passes out of the backfield, I think they definitely need to continue to bring Willie Gay along to the point where he's always out-snapping Ben Neiman. That will give them the weaponry, the athleticism to keep up with some of the teams that will see that weakness and exploit it point blank.
You mentioned earlier, specifically to Dan Sorensen, that his entire career has been built on, and I really don't mean this, as an insult, but it's been built on the coaches in the building thinking more highly of him than the people watching from the outside, which again, that's fine if it's working, I wonder if there's any of that, also with how they're bringing along Willie Gay and all of those things. And I'm just curious what you think, as you've now been kind of on top of Spags' defense now through almost 2 years with the Chiefs and looking at what these guys do and some of the little, trust advantages that Spags might give to the guys who are a little more veteran. I'm curious how much weight you think that carries and if you think that that's been largely well handled or maybe you'd like to see more risks somewhere, or even if you think that all really matters that much at all.
I think it's a mixed bag, and I think what we've seen is the tendency that maybe Spags has had over the years to go that just as a default position. I think it's been a little bit more based on positional need and ability this year. Hmm. We've seen Gannon and Morton play from the get-go.
That's true. That's a great point.
We've seen, I think the guy who has the shot to possibly become their best cover corner,
yep,
Legarius Sneed, played from the get-go.
Yeah.
Even after we heard about him having a tough time in camp and picking things up and not having the metal part all the way down. Yeah. And so I think that kind of bucks the system a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I think in Dan's case, Dan Sorensen confounds me, but I think does exactly what Spags does. The guy makes big plays.
Yeah.
He's going to be out of position against better athletes, which drives me nuts because I think that's a matchup you can control ahead of time.
Yeah.
But he's going to miss some tackles. But he just has a knack for making those big plays. And I think that is more of a plus in Spags' book, in the coaching staff in general's book, than some of the negatives or drawbacks. So the balance of it is that he's a guy that makes plays for them. And they're going to keep using him until they can't.
Yeah.
And at that point, it's about adapting situationally. The linebacker level, I think Matt House has more input than I think we give him credit for, and I think mm-hmm. it's about his comfort level with what he can do with his backers.
Yeah.
And when that becomes a comfort level with Matt House, then I think it will be something that we see change across the board.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. On the offensive side, there's been so much, strictly to the line, there's been so much turnover since the beginning of the season. Obviously, Mitchell Schwartz having the back issue that, he tried to push through a little bit in the Bills game and then left after one series. Haven't seen him since. He goes to IR. Obviously won't see him for another couple of weeks minimum. And at this point, I don't know if I'd bet on minimum just because it seems like there's a lot going on there. Back injuries are tough and all that. But on the other side, they bring Stefan Wisniewski back in. He'll be contributing relatively soon, I would think, or at least be available relatively soon. We've seen them go a little bit back and forth at center where Daniel Kilgore got a few games, but now Austin Ryder's back there. Nick Allegretti's been playing, and by most standards, it seems like he's been playing pretty well. Mike Rimmers has been at right tackle, and again, I think playing pretty well. But I'm curious how you've seen the offensive line, both as a unit and with some of those guys individually, how you felt that this year's gone in the trenches on the offensive side.
You know, I've actually been really pleased with the, you know, carousel that's had to go on.
Mm-hmm.
Just like with last year, Remmers walking in and being able to play a couple of different positions and be competent. He doesn't have to be stellar,
yeah,
but he's been solid, and I think that's all they need to give him. The thing that I'm most concerned about right now is it feels like Allegretti has progressed. It feels like while he's even, if not, he might have taken a small step backward, but I think he still has his moments. Certainly on the power, on the doubles, I feel like he's right at home and he does really well at that. Mm-hmm. The question mark to me is I thought the team did better overall with Kilgore in its center,
mm-hmm.
and I'm not sure what the preference is there, if it's just, again, defaulting to the veteran. It is what it is. That's going to be what it is for right now. I'm happy to see that Eric Fisher practiced today, mm-hmm. because I was concerned that if Fish had something serious where he might have to miss time,
that
makes all those things that we just said go up in the air, because the jostling of that offensive line would be so gigantic. You'd have to flip Rimmers over to the left. You'd have to probably move Wiley outside unless you're comfortable with Yazir Durant. Mm-hmm. I don't know if Witzman's in shape yet. Mm-hmm. I don't think Wiz, while he'll be available, I don't think they want to rush him because a pec tear is serious.
For sure.
And it's something that can be re-injured. You know, they want him for, you know, the wild card games and on. Mm-hmm. So I don't think they're going to press too hard. So let's cross our fingers that everything is right in Eric Fisher's world.
I'm glad that you mentioned Fisher because, I mean, I walked straight into the trap where I mentioned everyone on the line there except for Wiley and Fisher, because the other guys are new kind of moving parts that we're evaluating and everything. But I think because of all of that turnover and the fact that Fisher has just sort of been quietly, I would think, pretty darn good on the left side of the line, we don't spend that much time talking about him anymore, which is kind of a funny place for his career to have landed after being under such a microscope for as long as he was.
Yeah, you can see the solidification of his confidence, I think, is the thing that stands out now. I think it happened before the Budweiser end zone celebration.
Right.
I think that was kind of a marking point.
You're right, yeah.
You know, I mean, all the attention he got when he spoke about his game at that point, I could feel the difference in where he was a couple of seasons before that.
Yeah. I like that a lot. It's a little line of demarcation of, you know, new Eric Fisher kind of busting through there. Yeah, I think that's great. Specifically to the Kilgore Ryder thing and not totally understanding where the preference lies and all of that, I think it was Nate Taylor who mentioned at one point the idea that, you know, they liked that Austin Ryder, they're more confident that Ryder could deliver a snap to a in-motion Patrick Mahomes and that there might be a little more kind of chemistry in that. But also, Daniel Kilgore is a professional center who can, you know, I think snap on time. What kind of distinction would you make between those two, even as the Chiefs have kind of apparently given the reins back to Ryder for the foreseeable future?
You know, it comes down to one thing, and I saw that theory as well when I reviewed that Ferrari play.
Mm-hmm.
It is a challenging thing to do without a landmark back there to snap to. Mm-hmm. So I do believe that the volume of snaps that he's done in shotgun, in pistol, in all the different spots where Patrick can line up, I think that did play a factor in that.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that they didn't go away from it again tells me that they're still at the point where they're valuing Ryder's narrow margin of athleticism edge mm-hmm. to Kilgore's power.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, that's really what it comes down to, because I didn't see a big difference in the pass block volume between the two. But particularly when they wanted to run screens, when they wanted to run power in the run game, Maybe that was because it was trying to pair with Assembly when Ryder was in there before. Maybe Kilgore had a little bit a better matchup with guys the same speed and same size, that kind of thing. But I think those are really the distinctions. And I think they're very cognizant of not giving away game plan based on who that center is.
Yeah. And, I mean, we had so many conversations about the issues with the line through the first, I don't know how many, 4 weeks, something like that, and really maybe even earlier, because Osimile seemed like such a revolution for them, and then obviously suffered his awful knee injuries. But it does feel like things have, as a unit, even with the loss of Osimile and the loss of Schwartz, it feels like things have sort of stabilized, and to some extent also we were kind of having that conversation that we had a little bit last year about Mahomes drifting back in the pocket too far and making things difficult for his tackles. It seems like he's sort of picked his spots on that better. Do you feel better strictly from a pass pro standpoint just about that unit as a whole than you might have a few weeks ago? Does anything in there surprise you at all?
No, I think the coming together and the communication between the quarterback and the line, I think, has improved. That drift pattern that you saw, that's a key thing, too. But that also plays into what the defenses are doing. Because part of his drift is to enable for those super long routes to develop. And so if you're seeing cover sixes, which you saw against the Raiders, when you're seeing cover three and cover four back there at times, you know, that changes things. And so the delivery needs to come up in the progression, and you get the ball out a little bit faster. And I think both those factors are playing a role.
Let's look ahead a little bit, because I'm still trying to figure out what exactly to expect from the Buccaneers. I've watched a decent amount of them this year, and it seems like I've watched so many different games that have taken place on just different planets, where there have been great moments for Tom Brady, and then there have been the picks that we saw against the Rams on Monday night. There have been, you know, blowout victories and sort of dominant losses. What do you make of how they've come together at this point and what the Chiefs need to be prepared for coming up on Sunday?
First and foremost, the Chiefs need to have that pass blocking thing down. And I think they have to have a good plan for how they're going to help those five. I think it's going to get creative, and we know that they're going to blitz. And I think if they have any trouble early picking up those protections, I think you have to bring in somebody beyond Kaiser, to tell you the truth. I'd like to see Sherman in there in the H spot helping those tackles or something like that to try and add to that. But on the offensive side, I think what we've seen is that this marriage of what is, for all intents and purposes, an elderly quarterback,
right?
I don't know if anybody will use that word, with a biker of a head coach that wants to go for the throat every 5 minutes.
Right.
I think that what we've seen is, unlike Sean Payton, I don't think B.A. is backing him down enough. I mean, when you see Taysom Hill come in and he's throwing the deep ball better than Drew is lately, we know about his injury and all, but that adaptation is different. And I feel like I thought that the interceptions that Tom Brady threw last week were pushing beyond what he's comfortable with.
Yeah.
I thought that they're not giving him the underneath options that he always likes. There is no James White right now in their offense. Could they develop that? I don't know. The two guys, Rojo and Fournette, I don't know if they're capable of handling that volume of pass catching. And we all know what we saw from Shady last year. Yeah. If they're going to try to make him like the James White role, I'm not sure how well that's going to work either. So it's about the safety blanket, I think, and getting the head coach and the quarterback on the same page.
That's kind of fun to think about that, you know, because, I mean, we've seen this last couple of years with the Patriots, but Tom Brady, I mean, if you want to count tight ends, maybe the Chiefs would make their argument for this, and you can split hairs. But Tom Brady has the best core of pure wide receivers in the NFL, one of the most talented wide receiver groups in NFL history between Evans and Godwin and Antonio Brown. And it's not really the type of guys that necessarily fit his skill set. Like, I mean, it's kind of an awkward marriage there, right?
It is. It's, it's that midlife crisis.
Yeah.
You know, the guy just started dying his hair, and now he's got the vet with the top hair. He's not sure how to drive it right.
That's perfect. So Tom Brady is elderly. Bruce Arians is a biker. They're all having a midlife crisis. And right now, Chris Godwin is just running around trying to figure out what he needs to do to get the right amount of targets. That's where the Buccaneers are at this point.
Right.
I think that's fitting.
He's running the car wash, you know. He just got to show a little more leg, I think.
Ryan, I appreciate talking to you, as always. As someone who also has a large number of projects to direct people to, I know that the best way to share all that is from the horse's mouth. So please tell everybody the series of things you have going on and where people can get all your work.
Absolutely. Everything runs through Ryan Tracy NFL on Twitter. And the bulk of the new stuff is on rgrfootball.com. And that's the easiest way. So thanks for having me on, and happy Thanksgiving to you, yours, and everybody out there.
To you as well. I hope that we get to enjoy Thanksgiving, however we all can. And then on Sunday, we can all, you know, get together with our favorite elderly relatives, Bruce Arians and Tom Brady. Thank you, Ryan.
This is Almost Entirely Sports with Joshua Briscoe.
Radio is an empire built on Droopy Wee Wees.
On Sports Radio 810 WHB.
I have a couple of tweets to read. One that follows up on a story previously discussed here on Sports Radio 810, and then one is a tweet from Jason Kander. Someone tweeted him and asked for the best barbecue place in St. Louis. He said, "I know you're from KC, but I'm sure you've been to St. Louis plenty." Don't try the joke yet, Rudy, because I'm afraid you're going to steal it from Kander. He said, "The best St. Louis barbecue? Okay, it's a little off the beaten path, but totally worth it. Get on I-70 and drive west for 4 hours."
That's better than anything I would have said. The beaten path thing is a very good touch to that joke.
He also said, "As soon as your radio starts picking up KC stations clearly," that's going to be us. That's going to be us first. "Exit the highway anywhere. The first barbecue joint you see is the best barbecue joint in St. Louis." It's a good joke.
And he's not wrong.
What were you going to say? What was your joke going
to
be?
I mean, it was essentially the same thing, like, just like, you know, drive to Kansas City. Just, he said it much more clever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's,
you know, you find the best pizza in Kansas City or in St. Louis?
Is that
anywhere in Kansas City but Emo's, because St. Louis pizza is trash.
That sort of reminds me of a tweet from Ben Heisler.
But Emo's, if you want to just like give us money for any reason, I'll take it.
I haven't had it before. I'm sure I would love it if they
I will. I don't care how
I will
much
slather
I
myself in it.
Truly hate something.
I will smear it all
over
my body. $5
and I'll love it.
$5.
$5 is
if
all
it's
takes.
Free, I'll probably love
yeah,
it.
Yeah, that's true. Just give me one free pizza and I'm in.
Heisler tweeted, "Coincidentally, the best place for St. Louis pizza is also out of the way, about 4 to 4.5 hours northeast. Take 55 north and you'll eventually catch it. If you've dived into the lake, you've gone too far."
That's a good tweet.
It's also a good tweet.
Have you ever had deep dish?
I've not actually in never Chicago.
Had. Yeah.
I'm sure I had it at one point at like an old Chicago, you know, yeah. I feel like in my childhood at some point. But I
the only real complaint I think I've ever heard about deep dish is I just hear people say it's not pizza, it's more pasta, because it's
basically
deep dish, which
either
is,
lasagna or yeah. like just a it's a fondue at that point. Mm-hmm. It's a fondue pot made of bread. It's a fondue bread bowl.
Sounds pretty good.
I mean, yeah, I would definitely eat it.
I'm a big fan of the New York slice, just because it's just like mm-hmm. it's just one slice. You can just get one slice. It's massive. I like bending it, you know, folding it together. Yep. That's good.
For that reason, this is going to sound like a hashtag sponsored post, hashtag ad, but it's not. Johnny's absolutely kills the game in that sort of, because you get a whole pie. They got these big slices. You can fold them in a little bit. It's always good.
Very good pizzas.
Love Johnny's.
I'm a big fan of the Bronx too. The Bronx is a
not a sponsor.
Nice,
don't care.
A nice little joy. But you know what? The Bronx doesn't have that. Johnny's does have just a bunch of other stuff as well. That's really good.
Johnny's. So last.
Johnny's
oh, I got
everything.
So they have their wings. This is not a sponsored segment, but at Johnny's, if you wanna hop on this show, we with arms wide open.
Did you see that Kyle Brandt thing?
No.
Oh, Creed was on. What?
No.
Okay, you know Kyle Brandt has his 10 questions deal.
Yes.
Well, Creed was just on
it. I didn't see that.
And I think legitimately today they put out like a promo, like a clip, you know, video of it of Creed talking
That's
about
so
how
good.
Like, you know, like he does like find it kind of funny like when people make those jokes, because he's like I was just driving around and my son and my nephew were singing in the back seat and they were changing their voice like me and making fun of me the whole time.
Thing. Yeah, 100%.
I'm pretty sure that was today. I mean, here's the thing. Today legit feels like 3 days for
today's
me right now.
Week, yeah.
So, like, I'm pretty sure I saw it this morning, like, pre-flat tire. Like, yeah.
I did not see that today.
Yeah, Creed is coming to the Kyle Brandt with a 10 Questions for Kyle Brandt podcast. Not a sponsor, but Kyle, if you want to give us the money.
I think Creed is one of those bands at this point that, like, if Scott Stapp that was on the show, I imagine, right?
Yes, Scott Stapp, yes.
I think Creed is one of those bands.
Wait, is his name not Creed?
His name is Creed
Bratton.
Is it
not Creed from The Office?
It's Creed Bratton from The Office.
My life has changed.
I think Creed is one of those bands that I would, if someone was like, hey, do you want to go see the Creed show? And as back to the very beginning of the show, and they're like, hey, you have seats you can go to. Or like, we've got a suite at the Sprint Now T-Mobile Center, which I literally just remembered. I saw J. Cole at Sprint Center a minute ago, and I really was excited to see Jaden Smith, and he didn't show up.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that.
I can't even remember who else showed up. Who else was at that show?
Weird random fact about Jaden Smith. It took me a while because I was watching the new, essentially the theme song around the Miles Morales, you know, game.
Yeah.
I was watching like the person. It was like a music video, like Marvel had dropped, and I was just watching. I was like, man, this kid looks very familiar. His name, and it just says, you know, by Jaden. Like, man, this guy, Jaden Smith.
That makes sense.
Yeah, that's why I recognize him. It's a pretty fire song.
Oh, it's Young Thug and J. Cole.
I do remember your Jaden Smith experience.
It was
you were
really
not happy.
I was not.
He just dropped a fire song on the Miles Morales game.
That's fine. It really sort of soured my whole, like,
it's understandable.
Quiet sort of Jaden Smith fandom.
That's understandable. Like,
it was, you know why I didn't show up? It was his mom's birthday. They went on a safari or something. You had a tour date booked, my guy. What are we doing?
Here's the thing. I understand, like, not wanting to book a tour date on said birthday.
Yeah.
But,
just
like,
get your
been,
name off
but,
the
like,
damn flyer.
It's been booked.
Yeah.
You knew your mom's birthday didn't just sneak up on
Did
you.
Did not change.
Or at the very least, it shouldn't have. You knew when it was.
Should have known.
Should have known at the very least.
Also, to follow up on a previous story, final score, Samford 174, Greenville 99.
Man, Samford's really got to work on that defense, man.
It's not good.
We're running sprints tomorrow, boys.
Giving up 99 points in a college basketball game is not good.
If I'm the coach, I'm coming in. I am breaking the dry erase board. I'm throwing chairs. I'm punching a player in the back in the neck for his defense. I'm picking the worst defender of that group, and he's just getting punched in the back of the head.
And then I'm going to take $7 million right out the door.
$7.5 million and leave this place.
Boy, that's annoying. Do you know who the head coach is, Samford? They keep tweeting hashtag Buckyball, and I'm trying to figure out who Bucky might be.
Bucky Barnes.
They're coached by the Winter Soldier. Yeah, that's exactly right.
You would think their defense would be better.
Well, I mean, they're been frozen in a block of ice or whatever for a long time. They got a thaw out still. I'll tell you about their flames from three.
That's true.
I'm trying to figure out if this is someone that I should know, if there's like a weirdly like well-known coach that went there for some reason. Bucky McMillan. Do you know who Bucky McMillan is?
I don't, but I wish I did. Bucky McMillan needs to be coaching at the Power 5
Well,
level.
I think he might be on his way. So there's an
Come
SI
on,
story
Bucky.
Here. Bucky McMillan. McMillan.
Because he's making those millions.
Okay, so here's what they did. So this is a story from Pat 40 in Sports Illustrated. Okay, I don't... Pop-ups. The athletic director at Samford hired Bucky McMillan last week to be his new basketball coach. McMillan's previous college coaching experience? Not a minute. The 36-year-old had been the head coach for 12 years at Mountain Brook High School, just a few miles away from Samford's campus in Birmingham, Alabama.
So, hold up. This dude got a high... I mean, getting... I know it's high school, but
high school
a head coaching job at 24?
No. 36.
But he was 36
oh,
in
yeah,
college.
You're
so
right.
He got
the
high school job. He was 24.
Math's not my strong suit.
That's impressive.
He coached the Mountain Brook JV team at age 22.
Jesus.
And as a teenager, he had a couple of local AAU teams. Although that's not exactly the tried and true path to a D1 head coaching job.
Dude just wants to coach. It was like Frank Vogel has like a weird path to the NBA where he like had like no connections anywhere. And it wasn't like he was like a player or anything. He just like he ended up at a Division III school as a graduate assistant or, you know, student manager. And he just happened like cross paths with like an NBA guy. It was like some weird like you should have never even gotten a shot in the NBA because like you just like that's just how people just don't get to the NBA that way. I don't remember the specifics, but if you're listening, you're interested in the NBA, just look at Frank Vogel's story. I just remember it was interesting.
This is interesting just because this is, you know, the hashtag Buckyball thing, like really lean into who your head coach is.
For sure.
I figured there was something underlying there, but it's just he was a high school coach that apparently balled out and we're like, no, this guy can do it at this level. And his collegiate debut, they put up 170.
Dude, I mean, here's the thing. I love it. If you're Stanford, what else do you have to lose?
Yeah.
Like you can just do the whole boring thing, go hire some assistant coach in your league. No, man, you're Stanford. What do you got to lose? Go hire some cool guy named Bucky McMillan, who's a high school coach.
Such a good point.
Because, like, why not? And just because at the very least, you got Buckyball, man. Good for Bucky. I hope they average 170 a game this year.
I do too, because it seems like they're just trying to do like an air raid offense, basically. You know,
I'll tell you this:
no defense, no layups, all threes.
If
I gotta get the
if
box,
they
for
were
this.
Still making college basketball games, like, you know, in 2K and the EA Sports, like you start your career and you have to go to a small school. You can bet I'd be going to Stanford to like take Bucky all the way to the top.
This is apparently an exhibition game.
Yeah,
not in my heart, it wasn't.
Matter.
There's
no such thing as an exhibition game. Every game matters. These aren't friendlies.
Greenville scored 99 points. I'm not.
Bucky's not known for his defense. Okay, he's got to hire a defensive coordinator. We get that.
Here's the crazy thing. So on their way to 174 points, they were 12 of 21 on free throws, which I would have expected probably more free throws.
Sure,
because you can shoot those without the clock going.
How many?
Quick math. They scored 174 points. How many threes do you think they scored to end up with 170 points in an exhibition game?
Oh, man.
Their starter who played the most minutes was 21, by the way.
Three.
You think they made three threes?
Three threes.
I want you to try to. That's the good beards answer. But in this one, I would like you to try to get as close to the pin as possible.
Let's go with 48.
They made 20 threes. They shot 42. They shot sub 50 on 42 threes.
I mean, like 42 threes is a lot of threes in a game, but it's not like, you know what I mean? Like KU will shoot 42 threes a couple times this year. Like, that's not like a crazy, crazy number.
They were 71 of 111 from the field.
I mean, are they all seven foot and just dunking it out here?
They had 58 rebounds to Greenville's 39. It's not a bludgeoning.
There had to be like a massive height advantage, which feels weird.
I need a shot chart for this game.
Which feels weird saying that. Like, yeah, Stanford, their 6'5 center just towered over that 6 foot center for Greendale.
The Greendale human beings.
Such a good nickname, too.
How do you think it feels to be one of the four Samford players, excuse me, three Samford players who did not score in this game?
You're getting made fun of for a long time.
I'd like to give a shout out to Kendall Edmond for his 6 minutes, no points. Tyler Jelks, 3 minutes, no points. 0 for 1 from the field. And Zach Neighbors, 3 minutes, no points.
It's rough, man.
Get a shot off, my guy.
Everybody else was.
Zach Neighbors. He recorded one stat across the box score here in his 3 minutes.
Turnover.
Three personal fouls.
Oh, man.
In 3 minutes.
Hey, he hustles. He plays hard.
3 minutes. He's like a 28-year-old senior, I imagine.
He'll be back next year.
Googling. Wait, hold on. I'm sorry. This says Green. Hold on, was I looking at the Greenville stats? No, I've accidentally.
Oh man, I've really beefed it. Oh man,
I lost the box. What happened to the box score? I'm sorry. Those are three players for Greenville who did not score.
I mean, still.
All the team numbers I told you were correct.
Yeah.
Clay Holmes and Stanley Henderson, 4 minutes, no points for Samford.
Those kids are running laps tomorrow.
You know what? All right.
Well, what was their plus minus, though? Because maybe they played some good defense, and the defense like shored up a little bit in those last 4 minutes.
Stanley Henderson had 4 minutes. He had 3 rebounds and 2 fouls.
So we got a plus minus. I need some advanced stats.
He had 1 turnover. I do not have a plus minus for this Samford-Greendale exhibition game.
Can I get those synergy numbers?
Yeah, let me see here.
What did Kim Pom say?
You know what I can tell you? Neither team got a tech.
Ooh.
Clean game.
Clean game.
Clean game.
Respectful.
Samford had 26 second chance points, 27 fast break points. That's not...
Are we sure there's not like a typo and that one is like not supposed to exist?
It's just that basically... It's that they had... All right, here's... here.
They just played the most fundamentally executed game ever.
6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 11 players scored double digits.
They just
there's your fun stat.
They just played the most fundamental game of basketball that's ever been played. Passing with no dribbling, just shots at the rim, clean. Bucky's about the fundamentals, man.
21 steals, some good defense,
yeah,
there.
Man.
21-9 Bucky's, on the steal ratio.
Bucky's all about the fundamentals.
He doesn't buck around. That should have been their hashtag.
We don't buck around.
We don't buck around. Hashtag Buckyball.
Hashtag Buckyball.
I'm not going to say it again because I feel like I got lucky 3 straight times there and not messing that one up. I really do. The Greenville has 3 players, the last name Johnson.
But they're brothers.
I can't really verify that at
there
the moment.
There was, back in the day, I remember, it was in Sports Illustrated. Abilene High School made, like, Sports Illustrated because, like, their varsity team had, like, 8 kids on it, and, like, 7 of them were related. They were, like, brothers and cousins, and just, like, they just all, like, basically, and their dad was the coach. And like, or one of the fathers of the kids was the coach, and it was just like he had like 2 brothers, and they just basically all decided to have kids at the same time, and all their kids got to high school at the same time, and just a whole team of related kids. I just remember that being in a Sports Illustrated.
Weird.
Yeah, it was one of those like little like fun facts that they had, where they just had like a little random heist, like just like here's a little random tidbit from a super random place in the United States. Shout out Abilene.
What is Samford D1?
I bet that, yeah, I'm pretty sure they are.
If you would have said that today's show, if you would have put in the Facebook description on today's show that we were going to spend some time talking about the Samford Greendale exhibition game for 20 minutes, I don't think I would have believed you. And yet here we are. And we still haven't gotten to that Tyrann Mathieu sound because that's on brand as well.
We're not rusty. Just like Samford. Yeah. Oh, man. Samford's got a game coming up against Georgia. Samford.
I mean, I'm pay-per-viewing that if I have to.
They're in the Southern Conference. They are definitely D1. You know who else is in the Southern Conference? Your 2020 national champions, Kennesaw State.
Now, how did you have them winning the national championship?
I don't
again?
Remember, but like when back when we were. This is. I mean, we're talking back when, in March, when there was
like
still 3 of us.
Mid-March, yeah.
Talking about how I determined that Kennesaw State was the national champion. And then I believe Beards pulled up that Kennesaw State won like 3 games. I stood with it.
I do
Kennesaw
remember
State,
that
baby.
Now. Yeah, you
Kennesaw
sure did.
Kennesaw State.
Man, Samford's going to absolutely curb stomp Alabama A&M next week.
I cannot wait for the Samford versus Wofford game.
Oh, Samford Wofford. That's Bulldogs v. Bulldogs, right?
Yeah, but not the same kind of Bulldog. A little bit different kind of Bulldog.
Well, different logos, but they're both Bulldogs. And Georgia's Bulldogs.
Aren't they like different, like different breeds of Bulldogs, like is what I mean?
Actually, I think Wofford is a Terrier.
I think Wofford's a Terrier. Yeah,
it is.
Wofford's a Terrier.
Samford Bulldogs, Wofford Terriers. You know what that game's gonna be?
College game day, baby.
You know what that's gonna be, Rudy?
What is it?
You know what that game's gonna be?
I don't know if I wanna know.
It's gonna be a dog fight.
You're listening to Almost Entirely Sports with Joshua Briscoe.
Really? I must have blacked out. I do not remember saying that that's how we were going to start the show.
On Sports Radio 810 WHB.
We're probably not going to get to that Tyrann Mathieu sound, huh? I will say this. I thought we might talk about this tonight. Ran out of time. Seth Kaiser's article about the Chiefs' pass rush against the Raiders is out in the Chief of the North newsletter. I will read you the last sort of couple of sentences just to give you my favorite part, but I do want you to go read it. You can check it out, mnchiefsfan.substack.com. Tell them I sent you.
It'll be a little tough with the typos, but you'll get there. You'll get through it.
It ends with, we'll know whether the Chiefs have an Oakland-specific issue or a larger one soon, so there's at least that.
Well, I mean, hey, if they've been playing in Oakland, that's an issue.
It's a great point. That's a great point. If they've been even preparing for an Oakland football team, they're not. That's an issue. But the piece there is great. It does a very good job looking at basically it's Seth saying, well, not Chris Jones, at least, okay, guys? And it's good. He does it very well. But Rudy, you told me during a break previously that you wanted to yell at me about my Thanksgiving takes, and I honestly don't even know which one of them it is.
Oh, I didn't actually. It was more of a joke about about you wishing happy Thanksgiving.
So no, that's what it was. Yeah, you're right. It was a circle
was
back
just,
to the beginning.
The joke.
That's fine.
Yeah.
All right. Well, fair enough.
I'm sure you have a bad Thanksgiving take, though.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure I do.
Ramble.
I'll give you...
Green bean casserole sucks.
I really do like green bean casserole. And
most do.
I understand also.
It's
I was kind
a
of
super
thinking,
popular side dish.
I was thinking about it texturally. I understand why people wouldn't like it. It can be very kind of globby, but I don't care. I love it. It's fine. You want to know... So, back to Seth. Seth gives us a lot of content. Doesn't even know it. Seth thinks cake is clearly better than pie.
I mean, clearly?
By a lot, he says. It's a bad, bad child palate, bad, bad take. Pie is wonderful in almost every single form. I don't know if I've ever had a bad pie.
I'm not like even like anti-cake. And if you're someone who prefers cake, that's fine. I just don't think it's like this like clear cut, like, oh yeah, of course cake is better. Some cake is really good. It depends, but like your average cake is just
your average
just sugar.
I would say your average. I would argue that the average cake is not good.
Because
an average cake is gonna be pretty dry. The frosting is either gonna be like
we're just accustomed to it, so it's a
weirdly,
normal flavor.
Yeah, it's gonna be either weirdly metallic or too sweet. A really good cake. I had a really good slice of cake at a wedding. You know, that might be great, but I've never had like you can get literally one of those like $1 mini pies at Walmart or whatever.
It's pretty good.
It's gonna be good. Yeah. Pie is never not good. The single best Thanksgiving pie I've ever had is one that my aunt always brings. You can buy it somewhere. I don't know where, though, and I'm not going to have it this year. It is a pumpkin pie cheesecake pie.
Ooh. Intriguing.
It's the best thing ever. I'm not a huge pumpkin pie person. I'm a huge cheesecake guy. I'll eat any cheesecake anywhere, anytime. Breakfast, lunch, dinner, in my sleep. I'm snoring with my mouth open. Put a piece of cheesecake in there.
Funeral.
Put it. Oh my goodness. Bury me in cheesecake. When I go, bury me in cheesecake. I hope everyone has a wonderful Thanksgiving. Rudy, you as well. Everyone listening as well. I'll be back on these airwaves Friday. I'll talk to you then. Have a great Thanksgiving. Bye, Mom. Talk to you tomorrow.